Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How conscious are the decisions we make about what we eat and how much? Many of us, as we emerge from the pleasant but unhelpful fog of holiday indulgence, have stepped on the scale to find ourselves annoyed, if not downright baffled, that we found it so hard to simply say no to consuming more rich foods than our bodies could ever need. Former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Dr. David A. Kessler understands that frustration, both as a scientist and investigator of the food industry and as a human being who has struggled himself with the all-too-common American temptation to overeat. He recently adapted the key findings of his best-selling 2009 book, The End of Overeating, into a shorter volume aimed at educating teenagers. It's called Your Food is Fooling You, How Your Brain is Hijacked by Sugar, Fat, and Salt. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You're candid in the book about your own struggles to eat healthfully, despite the fact that you know what's good for you, you know it's not good for you. Can you tell us about the day that you decided to examine this phenomenon and then share what you had learned?
Now, the question for me is, why does that chocolate chip cookie have such power over me? What is it? I mean, why do I do what I think and, you know, wish that I didn't do, and why do I do it anyway? You know, actually, you know, one day I was sitting there, and it was late in the evening. I was watching the daily rerun of Oprah, and there was a woman on the show, and I still remember it. She said, I eat when my husband goes off to work in the morning. I eat before he comes home at night. I eat when I'm happy. I eat when I'm sad. I eat when I'm hungry. I eat when I'm not hungry. And then she looked in the camera and said, and I don't like myself. So why was this woman doing what she didn't want to be doing, but she was doing it anyway? She was successful in all aspects of her life. What is it? What is that pull? Sure, I can stop it, right? Sure, there's a moment, right, between my hand reaching out for that chocolate chip cookie and my putting it in my mouth. I certainly can stop it. But what is that pull? That's what I wanted to understand.
And you felt the need to translate all this information for a teenage audience because it seems like young people are prime targets now for the food industry.
I mean, if you can get, you know, it's one of the biggest gifts you can give a young person. Once you lay down the neural circuitry, I mean, in your brain, because, I mean, this isn't an abnormality. Right. This really isn't, when you think about it, it's not really a disease, right? I mean, this is how we adapt as human beings. There's highly salient stimuli out there. There are cues. Those cues arouse me. They focus my attention. They create thoughts of wanting. You know, I have the food. I have the reward. That momentary bliss, 2 minutes later, I go, why did I do this? Right? Then the next time I get cued, I do it again. I strengthen those neural circuits. I mean, it's learning, it's motivation, it's memory. Once you lay that down in your brain, you lay it down for a lifetime. So if you can avoid laying that down, and when does that get laid down? It gets laid down very early. And so that was the goal, to be able to talk to young people, not down to young people, not in a way to lecture them, just to explain what's going on.
Because they're at this time in their lives, many adolescents, where for the first time they're eating away from home more often. Mom and dad aren't deciding what's in front of them. They're making their own choices, even if they're still living at home.
Sure. I mean, and the fact is, it tastes good. But what is it, the one thing that an adolescent wants more than anything else? What do they strive for? What they strive for is independence. To be able to make their own decisions, not to have someone else be making their decisions for them. I mean, what's been the business model of the modern global food company? It's been to take fat, sugar, and salt, put it on every corner, make it available 24/7, make it socially acceptable to eat anytime. You walk down the street, we're living in a food carnival. So my goal was to help to explain, you know, in the young adult version, that your food is fooling you, to explain to young people what's going on, how their brains are, in fact, being hijacked.
So let's talk about the brain. So often we think about sort of eating healthfully and exercising portion control as issues of willpower, and we sort of characterize those who can't do it as having failed or being really weak. Talk about how that understanding plays into the new revelations of science about the ways that our brains are sort of trained to crave these foods.
In fact, you know, willpower is not going to work. Because, I mean, what when you think about willpower, that white knuckling, that denying yourself, I mean, once your brain gets activated, right, once those cues, you know, focus your attention, they create thoughts of wanting in your head, right? The more I keep it in my working memory, the more those thoughts are there, the more I'm going to obsess about it, the more I'm going to want it, the more it becomes a struggle. So in some ways, it's not a question of willpower. It's really changing what you want. And how do you change your brain so you're not getting automatically cued constantly, how these thoughts don't automatically end up in your head, and how they don't stay in your head once you're cued. I mean, a cue can be the time of day. It can be just walking down the street. Every time I land at San Francisco Airport, right, when the plane hits the runway, my brain starts thinking about these dumplings. Why? Because there's a place, I mean, in the airport, right? I mean, that has these great dumplings. So the plane becomes a cue. Remember Pavlov? What we
sure.
learned in, you know, in high school, the fact is we're very effective learners. So those cues automatically stimulate our attention, those thoughts. If willpower is just trying to fight those thoughts, you know, I mean, you're going to lose every time. You can do it for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, right? I mean, why don't diets work? I mean, they work. But they work in the short term because for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days, I mean, I could deprive myself. I mean, I could fight it, right? But then I go back into my environment afterwards and I get cued again. So those cues, unless I've laid down new learning, new neural circuitry, I don't have a chance of keeping the weight off.
And with those cues, this is so interesting. You write about the fact that if we're not careful, what started as a choice, as in I will go home and after dinner I'll have some ice cream, or I'll go out for some ice cream. If we don't really recognize what that is, then it becomes a habit, and we're not even really noticing the food we're consuming.
I mean, I can walk into the door at night after a long day. And, you know, automatically I find myself in front of the refrigerator. Again, we're such effective learners. I mean, this is the motivational, these are the memory, these are the learning circuits of our brain. I mean, anything I have done yesterday or the day before, right, I mean, that is highly rewarding, that's highly salient in my life, chances are if I have the opportunity, I'm going to try to do it again. So we really are, you know, that cliche of being creatures of habit. We are creatures of habit.
Okay, talk about this. I really like carrots. I really like apples, but I am in no danger of overeating those in the same way that I am, we'll go back to the chocolate chip cookie, with a couple of chocolate chip cookies.
So I want to know what it is for you.
Hmm.
I mean, or are you one of those people for whom food is not a very highly salient substance?
No, and we'll talk about that. I was interested to read that there is a percentage of the population that is that way. No, sadly, I really like to eat.
Well, you know, I don't want to cross the line here, right? But, you know, there are some people for whom food is not highly salient, right? And it really doesn't have the kind of emotional resonance. I mean, there are about 15% of the population for whom, you know, they'd rather be doing other things, and food does not stimulate them.
Are these the people, David, who become diet gurus? And I don't say that to be flip. I'm serious. It's so obvious to them what you should eat and what you shouldn't eat, and they're not tempted by things they shouldn't have. Are they the ones who are trying to give advice to the rest of us and can't relate?
No, I mean, it's hard to. Those are the people I really want to study. I mean, what was the name of the pilot that landed his plane on the Hudson River?
Sully Sullenberger.
Right. So here you have a guy. If I'm the pilot, right? If I'm flying and I'm just, you know, the birds have just gone into my engines. I've lost both engines, and I'm going, holy, you know, what am I going to do? Here's a guy who goes, no problem, right? I'm just going to land this plane in the Hudson River, mm-hmm. right? So does he have low emotional reactivity? Is there a difference in our dopamine circuits, or has he been trained so effectively that he knows what to do? Hmm. So we really don't understand. I mean, I do think there are some differences in people. You know, if some people are more outgoing, they respond to stimuli. Others are more withdrawn. Is that a result of learning early on in childhood, or is there something that we are born with? We still don't know. Now, I think there are certain people for certain reasons, I mean, who food just doesn't do it for them. I mean, they don't get cued by food. They don't get aroused. They don't have this focused attention. But for them, there are other things that are going on that have that salience. I mean, what do I mean by salience? I mean, if a bear walked into the studio right now, right, you would stop this interview and focus on the bear. If you smell smoke, right, you would start thinking about that and not the next question you're going to ask.
Sure.
Right? But, I mean, for some people, it can be, I mean, what's the most salient stimuli? It could be illegal drugs. It could be sex. It could be gambling. It could be tobacco. It can be alcohol. But what's the most socially acceptable salient stimuli that we've created? And what's at the core of that, you know, why is food so highly salient? The fact is that fat and sugar, fat and salt, fat, sugar, and salt stimulate me to come back for more and more.
Yeah, and you write about the fact that sort of perversely, when we have a few bites of whatever fatty, sugary, salty thing we've been craving, rather than that satisfying our appetites, it actually causes us to want more of the thing that we've just craved.
Why is the bag gone? Right?
Yeah,
why do I
right.
keep on
No
doing
one can eat
it?
Just one.
Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that's not, you know, some accident. The fact is, you know, I mean, you have to understand that over the last 20, 30 years, food has changed. It used to be that we used to chew food 20, 30, you know, times per bite. Today, food is so highly processed, it goes down in a whoosh, right? And it's so highly stimulating. I mean, fat and sugar or fat and salt, I mean, all I'm doing, because it goes down in a whoosh, I chew once, right? I mean, and it goes down. I mean, all I'm doing is self-stimulating myself.
Dr. David A. Kessler is my guest. He's former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration and author of the new book, Your Food is Fooling You, How Your Brain is Hijacked by Sugar, Fat, and Salt. We'd love to have your input in the conversation, and you're welcome to ask a question as well. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. David A. Kessler. He is former commissioner of the FDA and author of the new book, Your Food is Fooling You, How Your Brain is Hijacked by Sugar, Fat, and Salt. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. You mentioned, David, before the break that it's not so much that we and our inherent cravings have changed, but food has changed. Talk a little bit about how challenging it was for you to get inside the food industry, do some investigation, and really find out how it's being run.
The Washington Post sort of found me out because they found out that I was dumpster diving. If you go into the supermarket, you can look at the label, you can see what's in our food, but that's not true for restaurant food. And if you go in and you ask, what's the ingredients? What's it made out of? You're not going to find that out. You're not, certainly not going to see that on menus. Take any appetizer, in a modern American restaurant. What is it? Take buffalo wings, for example. Where do they start? So you start, with the chicken wing, which is the fatty part of the chicken, usually fried in the manufacturing plant. So that loads 30%, pushes 30% fat into the wing. 30% of the water comes out, usually fried again in the restaurant. That pushes another 30% fat into the chicken wing. What's the red sauce? It's fat and sugar. What's that white creamy sauce on the side? It's fat, sugar, and salt. What are we eating? We're eating fat on fat, on fat on sugar, on fat, sugar, and salt.
Hmm. It certainly doesn't make it sound so appetizing when you describe it that way.
No, it certainly has. It's highly salient. While I'm eating it, it captures me.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, we have made food, into highly salient stimuli. And it's not just the food itself, right? But we've taken that food and we've put it on every corner. We've made it available 24/7. We made it socially acceptable to eat anytime. Why haven't, until recently, the French gotten fat?
Hmm.
Right? The fact is, their social norms, they had certain boundaries. They would never eat walking down the street. They would never eat between meals. They would never eat, at your desk at work or in a classroom. We had obesity licked back, 30, 40, 50 years ago. We used to eat during meals. What did we do in the United States? We took down those boundaries. So it's not just the fat, sugar, and salt. Right, it's stimulating. It's also the fact that we eat all the time, and it's socially acceptable to eat any time. But what's the tagline for one of those fast food places? The fourth meal.
Yeah, and it's open until 3 in the morning, and so it doesn't matter when you want that fourth meal.
If you look what happened in Europe, it wasn't just, the fast food places opening and offering fast food. It was the fast food places were open all the time. So they took down when people eat. They took down those boundaries.
Yeah, I remember being struck in the mid-90s. I went to Russia, and you could find food when it was mealtime, but it was sort of indoors, and I don't know how much things have changed since then, but it wasn't on every corner. Even drinks were sort of harder to come by on the street. And the other thing is we forget that we can fill up on a lot of calories if we're not careful, just consuming something to quench our thirst.
Well, absolutely. But I may be dating myself, but certainly when I grew up, that was the way it was in the United States. Maybe you came home from school and you had a snack.
Right.
But we used to eat during meals. Now we eat all the time. And so it's the fat, sugar, and salt. It's the fact that it's, constantly available. It's those, what's the social norms. But it's also how we process foods. You asked me about carrots. Right. If you look at, how many times you have to chew a carrot? You have all that substance, around the nutrients. you have all that nutritional density, I mean, as well as the substrate of the food, that makes you chew constantly. Compare that to something you're going to eat, pick up, that's highly processed, compared to most, packaged foods. And there's no substrate left. I mean, what did processing do? In the 1930s and 1940s, in order to feed a hungry nation, I mean, the food industry learned to process food. So a lot of advantages. Cheaper foods, able to ship foods over longer distances, food safety. It took out dehydration. But it also, by processing food, took out the substrate. So the food went down much quicker. You can't eat a carrot in a second. It's going to take you, a couple of minutes in order to be able to get those calories. If I highly process it, I mean, if I take that carrot, and make it into a drink and make it into a liquid, you can consume it relatively rapidly.
Yeah, it makes me think about, we worry so much about children these days in addition to teenagers, and now they have these, you might have seen them in the grocery store or on the street, there's these like squeeze packets of like astronaut food filled with yogurt or applesauce or something. It's like there's no, you don't even have to go look for a spoon.
And that highly processed, look, there are advantages of food processing. Right? I mean, again, shelf life, expense of food. But the fact is, there's, when you look at it, the first question you should ask, is that really food?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Cynthia in Terrell. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, actually, I'm a nutritionist, and I run into, right, it's actually interesting that you're talking about children specifically because I work with a lot of children, and what I've found is that it's really true that where you see the overweight children is actually because they're drinking their calories. It's like they're drinking too much juice, so they're drinking too much milk instead of, like, eating, whole foods.
Have you seen it?
Sorry?
If you had more to say, Cynthia, go ahead.
Well, on that, I was going to ask, actually, about intuitive eating, and whether or not you had heard about that.
Sure. Define intuitive eating, because everyone has a little different definition.
The way I practice it, it's where you eat, it's recognizing your own internal hunger cues and eating when you're hungry and then stopping when you're satisfied. Not necessarily like stuffed, but just to the point of satiety.
Right. So I've tried it. Right. And people say, eat only when you're hungry. The problem is, I'm hungry all the time. And, so the question is, I can't be hungry all the time. If I've just eaten, why am I hungry? So what's going on, and I think we understand the neurobiology, what's going on in our brains, is that I'm getting cued again. I'm getting, these cues are arousing me. They're focusing my attention. You ever sit there and you're eating something and then you're thinking about what you're going to eat next? My problem is I can't separate out, and I think it's very hard for many people to separate out these feelings, these feelings of arousal, of wanting something, from hunger. But you're right. Most of these signals are, in essence, false hunger signals. And if you can stop and think for a second and say, is it possible for me to be hungry? I just ate. Then you realize that what I think I'm feeling hunger can't be hunger. It's just arousal by the, my environment and how my brain is being hijacked.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Karen who writes, how can you reset your food cues so that you don't crave anymore?
That's the major question, right? Because, my brain's being automatically cued. So, what's been... we have to be careful with this analogy, right? But if you look at what's been the greatest public health success to date, it's certainly in our lifetime.
Smoking.
So smoking used to, I mean, it worked the same mechanism, right? I mean, there were these cues, you know, the pack, the color of the pack, the time of day, which stimulate, would cue people to want a cigarette. And what did we do? You know, we used to view cigarettes as something that was sexy, that was adventuresome, that was glamorous. You know, we changed it. It used to be viewed as my friend. We made it, you know, into my enemy. So, you know, if something I view positively, the psychologists use the word valence. Something's positively valenced, right? I'll go toward it. If it's negatively valenced, I'll avoid it. So smoking in some ways was easy because I can avoid tobacco. I don't need it. Food is hard. So how do we change, you know, I mean, I have to change how I view it, how I value it. If I look at that chocolate chip cookie or that piece of cake and say, boy, that's going to be great, and it's positively balanced in my head, it's going to be very hard for me to avoid those cues. So somehow, and you have to believe it, right? And I can't just lecture somebody. You know, we all know what we should be eating, but the cues still are sending signals, boy, that's going to taste good. That's something I want. So you got to really change fundamentally what you want. And that's not something that happens overnight. I mean, that's what we mean by laying down new neural circuitry. But it's really, what do we value? Do I value these highly processed foods? Do I value these huge portions? Is that something I want? Is that something that's positively valenced, I mean, in my brain? Or is it something that I don't want? So we're going to have to re-look at food. I mean, I think the easiest way to do this is to look at what's in front of us and just ask the question, is that really going to satisfy me? Is that going to give me nourishment? Is that food?
Well, you know, David, part of our success in cutting the demand for cigarettes in this country, certainly there was a great deal of public information and people came to understand what tobacco could do to you. There was also, you know, some legislation and some regulation of how and where and when cigarettes could be sold and consumed. To what extent can laws play a role, if any, in getting us to eat better? Is Michael Bloomberg's ban on sugared drinks helpful or is that intrusive?
I mean, there's no doubt that laws can be tools, right? I mean, the price of cigarettes, where you could smoke. But in the end of the day, it wasn't laws or regulations alone. It's that we changed social norms. We changed how we as a society view the product. So they're tools, you know, and people are going to have different views on that. I mean, and yes, they can be useful, right? But, you know, they're controversial. We have to recognize that and respect that. You know, but there are certain areas where laws, you know, and regulations may be helpful. I mean, you know, a colleague told me that in one city, right, the average school-aged child drank 2,000 calories a day of soft drinks and juices and sugar-containing liquids. 2,000
a day.
A day.
Wow.
Right? I mean, just think about it, right, of soft drinks and sweetened drinks. So, I mean, I think we can all probably agree that we certainly want to use public policy when it comes to, school-age children, what's in our schools, what's being offered in the environment right around those schools. You know, it's hard for parents. I mean, they want their kids to be eating healthy, but then they leave the house and, you know, they can't control their environment. So there are things I think we can agree on, especially when it comes to children. But in the end, it's going to be, how do we as a society view what we're eating? And the food industry will change when we change what we want.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Shifra on the line in Dallas. Hi, Shifra.
Hello. I'd like to comment about portion sizes. Over winter break, I went with my family to Atlanta, and we went to the World of Coca-Cola. And while we were there, I saw a poster that clearly was from the 60s or 70s. There was a well-dressed woman in the poster. She was setting the table as if her husband's boss was coming for dinner, with a shrimp dinner on each plate and everything. And she had in her hand a bottle of Coca-Cola. And it said, the caption underneath this poster said, one 16-ounce bottle of Coca-Cola will serve 3 people on ice. And I figured out that that's a little bit more than 5 ounces of Coca-Cola per serving. So I'm thinking, I'm not so sure that it's soda consumption per se that's changed. It's the what's considered a portion size that's changed.
You raise a very important point. I mean, the fact is, if you look at where we're consuming these enormous calories, it's a fact that our portion sizes have increased. But why do we keep on eating these larger portions? Right? I mean, the fact is that we have to recognize that these huge portions, I mean, at the core of these huge portions, usually is sweetness. But sweetness alone, if I just give you a package of sugar and say, go have a good time, you're going to say, what are you talking about? But add to that sweetness, add fat, add temperature, add carbonation, add color, add mouthfeel. Say you can do it with your friends. Add the emotional glosses of advertising. So the fact is, we've made food, highly multi-sensory. Think about it. What is soda? Right? It's carbonation. It's a mild, pharmacological effect. But at the core, it has its sweetness and these multi-stimulating effects. That's what captures us.
Dr. David A. Kessler is with us. He's former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration and author of the new book, Your Food is Fooling You, How Your Brain is Hijacked by Sugar, Fat, and Salt. We'll be back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. David A. Kessler. He is former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration and author of Your Food is Fooling You, How Your Brain is Hijacked by Sugar, Fat, and Salt. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. David, can you talk a little bit more about how very deliberate it is in the food industry that foods come to us layered, as you say, in fat, on sugar, on salt? This is not some accidental process. The idea that food will have to go down easy and be able to be consumed within a few minutes, all of that is carefully calibrated in the lab.
Yes. I want to be careful on your use of the word deliberate.
Okay.
Does the food industry understand the inputs that fat and sugar and salt stimulate us? Yes. Do they understand the outputs? Do we keep on coming back for more? Yes. And I think they sort of reverse engineered. They looked where the long lines, they looked where the demand was. They looked at what stimulated, those sales. And they created foods that met those demands. Do they understand the neuroscience? I doubt it. Some may have had some insights, but I think they learned experientially, what gets us to come back for more. And certainly their business plan, the modern, global business plan of the food industry, has been, to sell, if you want to sell as much food as you can, you're not going to do it in just in 3 meals. You're going to have to put it everywhere, and you're going to have to make it available all the time. That's certainly deliberate. Did they fully comprehend the long-term consequences of the fact that once we lay, you know, they do that, once they stimulate our brains, once we become acclimated to that, once those neural circuits get laid down, this kind of laid down, be laid down for a lifetime. I don't think they understood that. I don't think most doctors understood that. I mean, I said I was lecturing to a group of, you know, these are the physicians, I mean, who really take care of weight control. Not the surgeons. They're the ones who really focus, I mean, on obesity. And you know, they had always learned, you know, it was energy in and energy out. There was a question of physiology and metabolism. And I said, how many of your patients, let me describe, you know, give you three symptoms, have a, you know, a loss of control, a hard time controlling their eating, you know, a hard time stopping, you know, once they start, a preoccupation of thinking about foods, you know, between meals. And I said, what percentage of your patients, you know, does that, do those three elements, those symptoms, you know, correspond to loss of control, lack of satiation, or preoccupation with food? You know, they said, you're describing my patient.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 95% of patients, either they see, have those three elements. And I said, well, what do you think's driving that? I mean, that's not the traditional physiology, you know, that we learned in medical school. I mean, those are elements of a conditioned and driven behavior.
So what do we do about that once we recognize it for what it is?
Where does it start from? It starts from the fat, sugar, and salt. It starts from the highly processed. It starts from the huge portions. It starts from, all these food cues that's stimulate me, and it starts from eating all the time. So we can, I mean, once we understand this cycle of cue, arousal, focused attention, you know, these thoughts, and we understand how it gets started, and we understand that we're going to have to change how we value, you know, what's stimulating us, because that's the only real way to do it. Is this something I want? Is this something I want to put in my body? Right? I mean, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take, you know, each of us as individuals saying, I don't want to be eating this highly processed, huge portions, fat on fat, on sugar on fat anymore. I want real food. I want stuff that's good for me. That's what it's going to take.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Suzanne in Flower Mound. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I appreciate your show. Thank you. And I don't know, you know, whether this is worth sharing, but I wanted to let you know how I lost 100 pounds.
Okay.
If you would be interested. My goal wasn't really to lose 100 pounds. I noticed when I was pregnant, I had gestational diabetes, and at the time I was in Connecticut, and they didn't make a big deal of it. They said, don't worry, after you give birth, it'll go away. But I didn't realize that was a precursor for type 2 diabetes. And then over, like, two decades, insidiously, the weight just came on and came on, and I ballooned. And I thought something was wrong with me. I'm so tired, so pooped, but still driven, working like a workaholic and everything. And finally, about 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with type 2, and I said, well, yeah, that makes sense. My father was a diabetic, my aunt, and all that. So I said, well, and the endocrinologist was very negative, said, you'll never beat this. You know, this is just, you're going to yo-yo all your life. And I said, well, let me go to a diabetic educator and find out what I need to do. So we always hear, you've got to eat right. Well, what the heck does that mean? What's right for you is not right for me necessarily.
So if you can just summarize, Suzanne, what did you do?
So what I did was every single day, I started out a little bit, but I've increased it to an hour a day. I either walk or I do water aerobics, or now I've taken up yoga and my new New Year's resolution is to try different classes at my fitness center.
Well, those sound like great ideas, and they obviously work for Suzanne. David, what do you think?
So exercise is key. In fact, it's very hard to stay at a healthy weight in our society without exercise. But exercise alone, it's going to be very hard. I mean, certainly if you're willing to do it for extended periods of time, you can keep, weight down by exercise. But think about it. I can eat a candy bar, right? It's 300 calories, and I can eat it probably in the next 2 minutes. In order to work off those 300 calories, it's going to take me close to an hour. So the balance is just not there. I mean, the fact is exercise is key. And for many people, I mean, it helps control their weight. But the real problem is what we're putting into our mouths.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Mort who says, I've been told the new sweeteners like Stevia and Splenda may sweeten the food or drink but not signal the brain that that sweetness has been consumed, and you might continue to take in more calories that add weight. Is there truth in those statements?
A lot him. About the artificial sweeteners that we don't know.
Still,
no doubt, the American diet is, the sweetest in the world. Go look at any ethnic food. Look at the home country and what's served and the way that ethnic food is sold in the United States. Ask the person at the restaurant, the Chinese restaurant, they'll always tell you they sweeten the food for the Americans. At the core of our overeating, there's no doubt sweetness is a major culprit.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's see. Let's go next on the phone to Jack in Dallas. Hi, Jack.
Good day. Yes, get right on into it. We often hear glucose, fructose. Are there any other sugars like maltose, and what are their derivatives? Thank you.
A very good question, and in fact, it's one of the things I regret is that, FDA commissioner, we really didn't deal with. There's so many different names of sugars, and what sometimes happens on the ingredient panel. This is the stuff below the nutrition facts. It's all those chemical names, and the food industry has to list. In order of predominance. So you would think that if there's a lot of sugar in it, it would say sugar up front. But in fact, when you read that ingredient panel, they can list the various names independently so they don't add up to having to go first. So there's glucose, there's fructose, there's maltase. I mean, there's literally endless names for sugars that can appear. And that's something that FDA really should fix.
Now, lots of people are convinced that sucrose, which is sort of the processed sugar that we know as sugar, is much worse for the body than, say, fructose or some other form of sugar. Is that true?
Well, some people are concerned that it's the fructose, not sugar is better than some of these corn syrups. And these more commercialized sugars than cane sugar. You'll see certain restaurants that are only serving soft drinks with real cane sugar and not high fructose corn syrup. Again, I think the jury is still out. I think the real culprit is the sweeteners. I think that's what's driving intake. I think that if we could reduce the sweetness of the American diet regardless of the form, we would be better off.
I would imagine, David, that not only in your personal life, but because of work, you have to eat out often. Can you talk about strategies that you use when you need to eat out and you want to eat sensibly?
I mean, that's where You know, you talk about choice. You think you, you know, get the choice when you're sitting there with the menu. But in fact, someone in the kitchen is really making those choices of what's in the menu and, you know, what's the how big those portions are. I find that if I don't think ahead of time what I'm going to eat, once I sit down with the menu, my desires and temptations are going to, you know, that bread is in front of me. I keep on getting offered, you know, multiple courses. I sort of have to have a plan before I even walk in.
So, in other words, you say to yourself, well, I would have eaten dinner and a piece of fish. I would have eaten, you know, a bowl of soup and a piece of fish at home, so that's what I'm going to have when I eat out, that sort of thing?
Well, it's not letting yourself be constantly hijacked or surprised. I mean, people who keep control of their weight, besides, you know, the very few for whom it becomes easy, you know, for the rest of us, we sort of have to, because we're constantly, you know, being cued and food's being put in front of us, you sort of have to have a plan.
So this book was written specifically with a teenage audience in mind, although I would imagine lots of adults could read it and get a great deal out of the content. But I wonder if you find that teenagers in particular get really mad when they realize the foods that they're eating and what they haven't fully understood about what's in food.
I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, the one thing, as we talked about earlier, teenagers want to be able to make decisions for themselves. They don't want to be manipulated. Being authentic is key. And I think, you know, as we rename the young adult version, you know, the food is really fooling them. And they want their independence.
Do you have hope that maybe this generation of young people could be the one that turns around the problems we have in this country with overweight and obesity?
You know, I was on a panel with some of the leading diabetologists. These are the docs who treat diabetes in the world. And I presented the data, some of the scientific data, and showed how the brain circuitry really does get hijacked. And they looked at what's happened in this country and looked at that scientific data. And their reaction was, we're toast as a country.
Hmm.
You know, once you lay down those neural circuits, it's very hard to change that. I don't think that's true. I am more optimistic. But it's going to take a real understanding. And it's going to take time to be able to change social norms and to change what we want.
Dr. David A. Kessler is former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. His new book is called Your Food is Fooling You, How Your Brain is Hijacked by Sugar, Fat, and Salt. David, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you very much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.